Sentiment Ultra Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Richard Hall, and today we are doing Greatest Games again. I'm joined by Emmett Gates. How are you, Emmett, today?
Yeah, very good, Richard. All good, despite the Super League shenanigans during the week.
We'll come to that. Certainly we will come to that. I'm really delighted to say we've got a special guest today, and that is David Ferrini, an Italian football commentator in Italy, based in Milan, on the English World Feed. How are you, David?
I'm good, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. And luckily for me, this week I've been flat out researching my games away from the Super League. So, yeah, it's been good.
Good. Excellent. And how's life? How's life in Milan?
Life in Milan? Look, it's good weather. I can sunbake on my balcony. Besides that, not much to do. Slowly opening up. Hopefully they allow some fans back in the stadium soon. So, we can get in there. So we'll see how it goes. But thanks for asking.
No problems. I mean, they're hoping, aren't they, for the Euros? Or even before, was it in May? Maybe starting from 1,000 in, am I correct? And then going up to a smaller percentage for the Euros.
Yeah, they want to start with 1,000 and see how that goes. I don't think there's going to be a big issue. There's lots of countries with fans in stadiums at the moment. And I think UEFA have kind of threatened Italy with maybe taking their Euro games away if they don't allow fans in. So I think the FIGC might have to come up with a solution, or maybe they have. I'm not up to date with that. But yeah, there was a direct threat from UEFA. So we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, well, let's fingers crossed, because it would be great to see him back as soon as possible, I suppose. Just a quick one as well, David. I mean, before we get into it, normally we just dive into the games, but I'm really interested just to know that, you know, obviously commentating on Serie A sounds absolutely fantastic, and obviously you do an extremely good job. And I just wondered how you got into this, because a lot of the people who listen to this website, believe it or not, are people who want to get into writing or wanting to get into things like commentary. We often get asked, to help writers, and a lot of them, you know, who've not written before, come and will write on our site. So it's just really, I think, it'll be really interesting just to know how you take that direction.
Look, I was kind of fortunate with how my entry into commentary happened. But basically, my background, I did a show in Italy for Guinness World Records. It was in Italian mainly. But they wanted the bilingual thing happening. So there was a little bit of English. I did that a couple of years back. And eventually, I made contact from there with some other people in Italy to sort of hang around for a while. I've been in between the UK and Italy. And then I met a gentleman on the web, actually, listening to him commentate a lot. His name's Patrick Kendrick, and he's one of the very best commentary people out there. And just got in touch with him. We got talking. Eventually, there was an opening for a commentator position in Milan for the World Feed. And, you know, I had to put the effort in and get stuck into it and come to Milan. And, you know, you have to prove yourself. You don't get live games, obviously, but came, did some time, had to battle through lockdowns and all sorts of travel restrictions. But yeah, I'm based in Milan now, and probably 5 or 6 months into it. So Patrick Kendrick, and also he's got very good content on how to sort of focus on your style. He's got his own YouTube channel. Should put the link up if we can after the pod. So, but yeah, very good content from Patrick. He helps first timers into it. But my background, you know, I come from music. I come from hosting events. So it was not foreign to me to do something like commentary. And of course, I've studied Serie A for 30 years, watching it week in, week out. So I've kind of got, I don't know if you could call it a PhD, but, you know, maybe at least some kind of master's degree in Italian football like you guys. So, yeah, that's how I got into it.
Now, Patrick's a great guy, and I've known from his time when he was at Inter, working with their media department. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, didn't he used to do commentary pre that, his time when he spent at Inter, and then he's gone back to it?
Yeah. Yeah. He started on the World Feed years ago, but yeah, he's done quite a few games, especially compared to myself. So I'm under 30 games, and he's probably you know, 50-fold that. So very experienced. He's done Inter TV and, yeah, he's absolutely nailing it. So good for him. It's a great example to follow.
Well, Emmett, you touched on this a minute ago. I've got to ask the question to both you guys. European Super League, what would... I pretty much know your reactions, Emmett, but I mean, I want you to just tell everyone what you thought, because I know you're quite passionate about that. And obviously, David, your reaction to it as well, because it came out of the blue, but it didn't come out of the blue, if you know what I mean. We all knew Agnelli was planning this with Perez for some time, but did the reaction shock you, Emmett, at the time when it came out?
You mean the reaction from the football fans? Or
your reaction?
I wasn't surprised because, you know, the looming threat of a Super League, they've been talking about it for so long, almost since I've been interested in football. So you kind of felt that one day it would happen. But for it to happen at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night, the timing of it was absolutely absurd. The shocking thing to me is how quickly it imploded. You know, we basically, from Sunday night to Tuesday evening, there was a Super League, and then by Wednesday morning there wasn't. But I just feel, you know, I like, we've talked about this before, and my feelings are pretty much the same as everyone else's. It's complete greed driven by American owners who can't come to grips with the concept of relegation and promotion. Obviously they come from a culture of closed shops like the NFL, NBA. But if you take that away, what are you fighting for? Like, if you know, if you're Arsenal, you could finish 10th in that Super League, and it's Arsenal, so they probably would finish 10th. You know, that's,
you forget the Spurs.
Yeah. Yeah, somehow Spurs got tagged along into this Super League. But, you know, you could finish 10th 10 years in a row, and you're still going to make lots of money, but you're just, you're just there. You're not, it's lacking all ambition, and it's just to make the rich richer. You know, they come out with this spiel about, oh, the football family and the pyramid and the money will trickle down. No, it won't. No, it won't. Players will earn more money. The clubs will get more money, and they in turn will pay agents and players more money. And that's it. Like, very little of the money actually would have trickled down to grassroots and the lower divisions. Yeah. And all this, all the rhetoric that they come out with, you know, but it's beneficial to the game. It's complete nonsense.
No, I can see that. I mean, David, from if I'm going to just be a little bit awkward here, and I actually agree with the majority about the Super League, but for what it's worth, but, you know, the Milan Ultras came out with that statement, which I thought was interesting, where, you know, they said, OK, you can be annoyed about it, but it's hypocrisy, because shouldn't we have been annoyed about this at the start of the Champions League, for instance? Because we've seen clubs from the UK, clubs from England, really, clubs from Spain, Italy and Germany dominate that competition since its inception. And no one really sheds any tears for poor old Steaua Bucharest and Red Star Belgrade and those teams that have, you know, gone by the wayside in chances of winning it. You know, and it's just another, obviously they admitted the Super League was just another incarnation of football going in the wrong direction. But, you know, you can look at the start of the Premier League. Is this something that's just, you know, is it hypocrisy? Or, you know, what's your take?
I don't really know the full extent of what the Super League is, and I think that's a problem for most people. We realize the threat of a breakaway competition. It's kind of like, for people that have watched The Office, the US series, Michael Scott starts his own paper company and wants only his mates to come along with him. And, you know, a small group breaking away to form a league that they're always going to be in. It's kind of like the cool kids at school. So, you know, the nerds can't join in, and, you know, it's a difficult situation, especially for the other, you know, the hundreds of other clubs. And, you know, as I think Emmett was saying, you know, why are Tottenham and Arsenal, those kind of clubs in there? I think they've done their cost-benefit analysis, and they've realised the overseas fan market for Tottenham and Arsenal, and you know, most English clubs, to be honest, are just huge. I can see a long-term plan. I don't think it's a short-term thing. I think it will, even though it's, you know, as most people are saying, it's dead and buried. I'm not sure it is. I think it is based definitely only on, you know, the financial aspects. But, you know, I would love to see the research that people are claiming that they've done to say, you know, the ages between 10 and 14 or whatever it is aren't interested in football anymore. I don't believe that. I think there's lots of interest with, you know, males and females now. There's this huge interest, especially with female football becoming a lot more interesting and professional. So the excuse book is long. I think that it's going to go ahead at some point, and I think that cutting out the middleman, which I guess to them is UEFA, is, you know, with all the debt that's involved with these top clubs now, they're trying to get rid of that. I guess that's why banks are, you know, organizing the whole thing and funding it. I don't know enough about the Super League to be able to make a definitive statement, but from the bits that we've seen basically on Twitter for the last 72 hours, yeah, it's definitely based on financials. Most people will call it greed. The statements from the club presidents were a little bit, you know, up in the air. It's trying to save football. I'm not sure who they're saving it from. There's lots of interest there. You know, didn't ask the fans. We've seen the Liverpool owners come out and apologize to their fans and, you know, sorry, we didn't ask you questions. Well, you know, at the end of the day, a team like Liverpool is always going to fill its stadium because it's become a multinational sort of globalized corporation where there's busloads of foreigners turning up to games and most of the locals are priced out of the seating market. So, you know, clubs like that, I think they know their standing in the world. They know that they're always going to have fans and, you know, it's bold. I won't say it's brave, but it's definitely bold, and most people can see kind of the intention, and it is to create this very elite league and only the cool kids can be in it. And it, you know, sport's about merit. You know, as a lot of people have said, if you have six teams guaranteed every week from the English Premier League to play Super League, then, you know, they might play kids when they go and play Premier League games, you know, against your West Hams or your Evertons. And it's not fun to watch. It's kind of taking the mickey out of professional football. The trickle down, I'm not sure about where the money's going. I don't think anyone is. We just know that there's billions of US dollars involved in a bank. So people need to know more. I think the clubs need to be a little bit more transparent. But yeah, lots of questions, lots of speculation, but I think most people have hit the nail on the head so far. And that's why it's fallen over.
Just to add on to something that David said about, you know, the it's infamous now, the 16 to 24-year-olds are losing interest in the game. Andre Agnelli, who has come out of this looking like a complete moron, to be honest, judging from his comments, I think it was Il Corriere dello Sport, he had an interview, and he was talking about how the 16 to 24-year-olds on FIFA, they can create their own league, and this is what we need to do in real life. Yeah, but on FIFA, teams can still get relegated. You know, even if it's a computer game, they can still get relegated. But he thinks that it's just a closed shop, which clearly shows that he actually has never played FIFA, even if it is a video game. It's, you know, teams can still go up and down. You clearly haven't done your research.
I think he had his own game on the press ready to come out. I think it was ESL 21. Maybe a deal with EA Sports, but didn't quite make it to the shops this season, this summer. And yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Absolutely. It's funny that I think you both hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think these clubs have looked at this as purely business decision. And I suppose as a business, they are within their rights to do so. You know, they've lost money in this pandemic and they've realised there's a chance to gain that back. And you can see, as you referred to before, you know, you've got JP Morgan funding whatever, $4 billion or whatever the figure was. And if you're looking at the debts of those clubs, it amounts to almost the same figure, which is not a coincidence. And, you know, they've thought, you know, we can all see if this had gone ahead that the games would have soon been played in China or the US and it would have been advertised as the iconic homecoming game at Anfield for Liverpool that happened once a season. Yeah. And, you know, you can almost see how it would have panned out, and it would have made those clubs richer. So from their point of view, it's that, you know, for, if any corporate business would do that. And I think that, I can't remember who said it, I can't remember who to quote now, but it was on the television yesterday, that football can't be treated as a corporate business because it is more than that, and it does involve that. So anyway, we will move swiftly on back to when football was better, quite frankly.
Yes,
let's do it.
Let's do it. So anyone who's listened to this before, if you haven't, let's just quickly explain it. We're just interviewing and wanting to know people who are involved in football, and especially Italian football, of course, what their favourite memory of Serie A, Serie B, a European game involving Italian clubs is. We've had some crackers before, but this one I know that Emmett as well will have special interest in. And so, what, I mean, David, please just set the scene and take us through this, because there is something very memorable about this, and it's a cracker you've picked, to be fair. First of all, can I ask you, was this, how did you see this game? What's the background?
I grew up in Australia, in Brisbane, and it was about 2 a.m. Australian time when I saw this goal go in. That's very memorable to most people. So that set the scene. We always watch Serie A and all European football from sort of midnight to 7 a.m. in Australia, depending on where you are. But that's the scene. And at a coffee shop, a prominent one in Brisbane that's known for showing the Serie A games. You know, there's always half a dozen fans still sort of pottering around at 2 a.m. to, you know, have a cigarette in one hand, a cappuccino in the other, and watch Serie A, which is good, which is great for us, because it was either that or wake up the old man at home to get on Rai International to see the game. So that's the scene.
It's amazing. It always really does amaze me, the loyalty of foreign fans who, especially, you know, like you say, you have to get up at ridiculous o'clock in the morning to do that. I mean, some of the Inter performances I've watched over the last God knows how many years, I was annoyed at enough. Never mind if you got up at 2 o'clock in the morning to do so. So that's a special credit there going, I think.
Oh, thank you. There's plenty of Aussies that do it. And it's just been that way. We in Australia, we used to get one game a week on a replay with a couple of minutes of highlights after it. We used to get 7 days after the game was played. So that was the 80s and 90s most of the time. I remember watching the English First Division on a Monday night, usually sort of 6 or 7, 8 days after the previous weekend, we get the highlights on the ABC. And, you know, you get to see Paul Gascoigne, you know, smashing one in the top corner, or Eric Cantona kicking someone in the crowd in the chest. But and that's what we lived for. It was amazing. And look, we've got to watch primetime TV and then stay up till late to see the game. So it kind of worked out. And working in music, I was always up at that time anyway. So it was perfect for me.
I sympathize with you, David, because I used to live in China and South Korea. And I would have to get up at like 3:45 in the morning to watch Juventus games. And especially during the Conte era, you know, you weren't seeing really good football. So you would wake up to see Juventus and, I don't know, Crotone or Benevento or Sassuolo, and, you know, the slug out a 1-0 win. And you just think, I get up at 4 a.m. to watch this. And by the time you go back to bed, the sun's coming up. So you get like 4 hours sleep, and you just, the rest of the day is a struggle.
It hurts, especially for my mates that were always sort of having day jobs. I had the luxury of going to bed at 6 a.m. and, you know, working in music with bands and DJs. It was always an absolute luxury to sleep until 2 p.m. if you needed to. So And then I get up and watch it again if we've taped it on the old VCR. So yeah, good days.
Well, that is one, just to kind of go off. That's one criticism I've always had of Serie A, is that they always think of, that's what the Premier League, I think, was visionary, and that they catered to worldwide fans, whereas Serie A was just focused on fans in Italy. You know, with the late kickoffs, they never thought of fans in China and Korea and Japan and Australia and America even. And now they've been playing catch up for 20 years.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. It's been something that the UK have done so well. The English Premier League, the way it has its marketing structure and the way that they've attacked all the markets, it's the reason why they've attracted such a global fan base that Italy used to have, based on the skill and the tactics of the game. And always, pre-Bosman ruling that you could have only the three best foreigners join in, and it was always Italian teams. The 90s we saw Parma and Lazio, and as well as the big three sort of playing in Europe. Saw Sampdoria make a European Cup final. Those are the days, and that's why people were attracted to the game. The English Premier League was in all sorts in the early 90s, and it wasn't until they restructured with their marketing and that that. They did the cost-benefit analysis. They went around the world and they reap the rewards. And you've seen teams now that are, most of them, some of them are in Div 1 now. Your Hulls and your Wiggins and those teams that have still got, overseas fan bases.
Absolutely. You sit in a coffee shop in Brisbane. It's a ridiculous 1 o'clock in the morning, and I don't even know if we've told everyone what the game is yet exactly. So it is. I'm just, we're talking about it, but we've not gone through it. So tell us who you're watching. Tell us what you're expecting from this game.
Okay, at the time, I'll just name a couple of players to kick it off with. There was Zinedine Zidane. There was the current Inter coach, Antonio Conte. There was a rock at the back called Ciro Ferrara, the world's best goalkeeper at the time, arguably, Edwin van der Sar in goal. And up forward was Pippo Inzaghi and Alessandro Del Piero. So Juventus were chasing Roma at the time for the Scudetto. They were a few points behind. Roma had Battistuta at the time, and they were trying to win their first Scudetto since the mid-80s. So it was a game that Juventus were at home playing against one of the minnows of Italian football, Brescia. Who were doing okay in the league. I think they were around seventh or eighth or ninth at the time. But they had a player that people, I don't know anyone that hates him, but there better not be anyone that hates him.
Marcello
But
Lippi.
yes, well, Marcello Lippi, we can go into Trapattoni as well. But Roberto Baggio had left Inter Milan, joined Brescia. And for me, he was one of those players that, he's always in your heart. The amount of joy that he brings Serie A supporters, and at the time he was, especially in the 90s when he was at the peak of his powers. Obviously, Brescia is not a super club, talking about the Super League, but not one of the bigger clubs. Baggio had already played at Juventus, AC Milan, and also Inter Milan. But his best years, in my opinion, were definitely not at Inter, probably his worst, but definitely not at Milan. He had a couple of good years at Juventus. He got his name at Vicenza playing third division, then went to Fiorentina, and that's where he made his name. Signed by Juventus, ended up at Milan. From there, he went to Bologna and had his best ever season in terms of goal tally. Only stayed there the 1 year to impress Cesare Maldini. So you try and get selected for FIFA World Cup 98. But then after that, went to Inter, didn't work out for him, ended up at Brescia, and they didn't have much in depth. Well, they had the Filippini brothers, for example. They did have a young superstar in the making that most people will know of, the current Juventus coach, Andrea Pirlo. He was in the Brescia midfield. So that's the two teams, Juventus against Brescia. And it was at the old stadium, the Delle Alpi.
Was Dario Hübner the Brescia at the time? Just trying to think.
Yeah, he was. Il Basin.
Yes. Quality player. Absolute cult hero. He's, certainly was a good player. So, I mean, Emma, you obviously remember this game as well. I mean, what do you think? How are you rating Baggio at this moment in his career as well? Because I know that you've written extensively about Baggio.
Well, I mean, at this stage, he was 34. And he had actually struggled. I wrote about this recently for the website in celebration of the 20th anniversary of his goal in this game. And the Serie A in 2000-2001 started later. I think there was a player strike over the summer. And it actually didn't start until October 1st, 2000. And Baggio actually, he didn't score, and then he jarred his knee attempting a volley against Lecce, and he was ruled out for 2 months. So he returns against Fiorentina at the Stadio Timio Franchi in late February, and he scores two, with one being a trademark free kick that crashes off Francesco Toldo's crossbar. So he had only scored two goals before this game. And he wasn't in the greatest of form. And obviously, his stint at Brescia was his longest stint at any club from his time at, going from his time at Juventus. So you're talking 5 years of constantly changing clubs until he lands at Brescia in the summer of 2000. But he wasn't going through the best of form. But I mean, a player like Baggio, you know, the saying goes that class is permanent, you know. just because he's not in the best of form doesn't mean you leave him on the bench or you put him in the stands like so many coaches did. You just need to get his fitness levels up. As he said himself, you know, he was only maybe 100% fit 4 or 5 times a season. A lot of the times he played with, well, most of his career he played on one leg, and sometimes that leg would go. You know, you just needed to get him physically in the right condition, because, I mean, his ability with the ball is, I mean, you're talking one of the best in the history of the game, his manipulation of a football.
Yeah, I think, absolutely.
So when you're watching that game, David, I'm not asking you this. I mean, obviously we know that Emmett would have been sat there dying for Juventus to get a result here. Cause I think everyone knows my leaning, so I would definitely have been on the Brescia side. Was there a particular leaning you had in this game? Oh,
yes, definitely. Roberto Baggio, any team that he's playing for, usually, that is. I'd have to probably disappoint you both here and say if he was playing for Juventus or Inter, definitely going for the other team. But, you know, those two teams have love-hate relationships with everyone. So, look, definitely going for Brescia. Roberto Baggio, he's such a presence on the field. And yeah, like Emmett was saying, every time he is on the ground and clutches at his leg or his knee, it brings that sinking feeling to everyone that's watching the game. But yeah, he's just such a dominant figure. And he was up against the likes of Zidane and Del Piero in his game. So, you know, to achieve what Brescia did in this game was absolutely huge at the time. And it had a massive knock-on effect for the rest of the season. So
just talk us through some of this game. How did it sort of come to pass by the end of it, after 90 minutes? You probably wouldn't have thought then, but all those years afterwards, you'd still be talking about it on a podcast.
Well, it's definitely the quality of the Baggio goal. Brescia didn't have too much in the game. It was all Juventus in the first half. Del Piero had a couple of free kicks. One of them hit the post. Baggio got forward and tested Van der Sar in the first half. You know, it was a look up and shoot off the outside of the boot. Van der Sar managed to save it in the near post. There was, you know, Zidane to Pesotto, who is a Juventus legend, who crossed in. You know, he crosses into the area. Del Piero with a cheeky back heel volley attempt at goal. Good save by the Brescia keeper, which is Cernicek. I mean, the names for Brescia in this game are not that great. Let me just run through a couple of them. There's Pavel Cernicek in goal. There's Calori.
Forgot Pavel Cernicek was even there.
Yeah, he was there and he was the main keeper at the time. There was Calori, Bonera, Galli at the back with Amor Diana, for those who remember him. He was on the right. Jonathan Bacchini on the left.
Jonathan Bacchini. There is a name I haven't heard in a long time.
Yeah. And I think he was clean shaved in this match. So usually known for his big rugged beard. You had the Filippini brothers, Emanuele and Antonio. Then you had Andrea Pirlo in the midfield. Very young. I think he must have been 21 or 20, 2 at the time.
21.
Yeah. And I just remembered he actually was in Australia for the Olympic Games in 2000 and scored the goal that beat Australia. So another reason for Australians to hate the Italian national team after 2006. And then Dario Hubner up front, the number 11, Roberto Baggio, the number 10, with him in support. And it was, a very young Andrea Pirlo, we'll go with that. You know, he's playing 1-2s with Baggio. They rarely go forward, but you can see that Juventus had fear in them whenever Baggio or Pirlo got the ball. The Filippini brothers were out there as the hitmen doing the Gattuso job to try and put Del Piero off his game. Del Piero was having a great game. And of course, for those that know, especially the Italian national team history in the 90s and even 2002-ish, there was always that debate. Do we take Del Piero or do we take Baggio in the final 23-man squad that goes to the Euros or the World Cup? And Baggio was always left at home for the Euros. And it was always, Juventus sort of pushing a couple of their young stars in. And, you can't blame the FIGC for wanting to take, and the coaches for wanting to take Del Piero. Magnificent player, but, there's only one Roberto Baggio. And for me, it was always a travesty to not take him to the Euros. And I was hoping that he would get the call up for the 2002 World Cup in South Korea and Japan. So the game was heating up. Brescia were aggressive and then sort of began their mission to close down Del Piero. Juventus thought they should have had a couple of free kicks. The referee, Gennaro Borriello, he was saying no to them. There was a bit of aggro in the game. There was that feeling amongst the Juventus fans in the crowd. It was in Turin. Brescia, the visiting team, they didn't have too many fans in the stands. You could hear the fans cheering on a goal that Verona scored as well at the Olympico because Roma were playing against Verona that day. And Verona went up 1-0. So it was actually a future Juventus player, Mauro Camoranesi, that scored for Verona against Totti and Batti's Roma. And at the time, Roma were on 55 points in first place. Juventus were 7 points behind them on 48. Lazio were third, and Parma were up there at the time with 40 points. So the race for the Scudetto was still on. Roma were the favourite based on the big signings that they'd had in recent years. And after half an hour, that ruthless volley from Gianluca Zambrotta went into the far corner. Juventus were ahead, the goal effectively taking Juve to 51 points while Roma was still losing at home. So it brought the gap back to 55. There was a lot riding on this game. There was a Juve corner taken by Del Piero, went to the middle of the area, was headed away. Zambrotta chested it down and, from the clearing header and just smashed it into the far post. There was nothing Cernicek could have done. And you can see the highlights, Ancelotti fist pumping on the sidelines. I don't think he was having a good spell at Juventus at the time. There was a sliding hack from Mark Giuliano on one of the Filippinis to, a bit of revenge for what was happening to Del Piero during the game. Free kick a long way out. Baggio and Pirlo standing over it. Baggio leaves it for Pirlo. So, you can see the respect from the old guard to the new with Pirlo being allowed to take the free kick instead of the great Roberto Baggio. But at halftime, it was Juventus 1 and Brescia 0. Juventus needed to come out and make a point in the second half. They needed to win, and they decided to get a little bit more adventurous. Zinedine Zidane was nowhere to be seen in the first half. He starts getting more involved. He gets his first chance on goal, hits one from 25 yards, and it goes wide. Super Pippo, absolutely nowhere to be seen as well. He's being kept quiet by Bonera. And, Cernicek has to save another one from Zidane, who by this point had tried to enforce his status in the game. Dario Hubner for Brescia, non-existent as well. So it was all Budge or Pirlo, or there was nothing happening. And it was all about marking up and trying to give Juve's midfield outlet some trouble by pressuring them. Takenardi included. He was, you know, that little hack to the legs from one of the Filipinis. You know, they're like two annoying chihuahuas that just won't leave you alone. So, there were, you know, a passage of play by Juventus down the left-hand side, starting around the halfway mark, pressure of pressing, Pesotto, he's hemmed in by the sideline, lobs a ball to Zidane. He's also hemmed in on the sideline, but you know, a little bit more advanced up the field. He chests it down with his back to goal. The skill level was immense in this second half. You know, Zambrotta, he made a 40-meter run to cross in for Del Piero. The header, he was just a little bit too short for the curling delivery. That was something I remember, was Del Piero had so many half chances. He could have scored three or four in this game. There was a clearance that came to Zidane. He's outside the box waiting to shoot. It goes over. Emil Diano is having trouble on the right-hand side for Brescia. He's getting absolutely destroyed by Zidane and Pesotto. Bacchini on the left. Nothing happening down there. Brescia had hardly any of the ball. It was all Del Piero in this game. He was everywhere from midfield to attack. Baggio nicks the ball away from Takinardi, I remember. And finally, Brescia have two men on the counter. And you could just hear the fear in the Juventini, the tifosi in the stands every time Baggio got the ball. So Pirlo, he takes the ball forward. He's got Baggio on the left side. He takes a couple of touches, shoots. It's deflected out for a corner. In that play, you could really feel the panic amongst the fans. So, you know, they were hoping to God that Budgel wouldn't end up with the ball in a shooting position. Van der Sar, for most of the afternoon, didn't even have to make a save. Svanicek with loads of saves to make. Iliotade was even getting back to defend. He was one of the other players that came off the bench. And, you know, with 5 minutes to go, Brescia are showing no innovation. Rarely get past halfway. A poor Brescia clearance goes straight to Antonio Conte for Juventus in the midfield. It bounces awkwardly off his boot. Goes straight to Pirlo for Brescia, who tries to get things moving to the left of midfield. Zambrotta comes infield and hacks into one of the Brescia players. The ball comes back to Pirlo. He looks up, launches a ball forward, and the viewer at home cannot see what he's aiming at the, you know, as Brescia are attacking. The Brescia attacks out of screen. It appears as if it's a hit and hope, similar to, you know, Div 2 football in England. So the camera pans right. There's a pack of players and the ball is beautifully weighted. And then you see this blue shirt and a ponytail on the far right of screen. Three Juve defenders and the Brescia, you know, 11 are looking on. The ball is brought down by Baggio, who by now is in between the chasing pack and Edwin van der Sar, who's in no man's land. He doesn't know whether to come or go. He's basically standing on the penalty spot. And the sheer brilliance and vision of Roberto Baggio, who was able to keep one eye on the ball and the other on the Juve keeper. He possesses the finesse to touch the ball away from the goal and the keeper just perfectly enough, with just enough weight on the touch to then change his running angle, judge how far back the defenders were that were chasing, and then tuck the ball away into the corner with his left boot. And that's it. That's the goal.
The only thing that was as good as that goal was the way you described it. You've set the bar now. That is the bar. That was brilliant. I was reliving that again myself completely then. That was fantastic. But, I mean, look, that goal, anyone who's not seen it, I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, I can't describe it better than you just did then, but the vision of Pirlo and the calmness of Baggio, as you say, it's phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, Emmett, you've, like I said, you've written extensively about this goal because you as well would have been sat there, you know, halfway, well, around the world. We're all watching that at the time. I remember it clearly. And it stays with you, that sort of goal, doesn't it? It's just superlative.
Yeah, it was almost a hidden gem in Baggio's back catalogue of wonder goals up until recently. And I'll probably take some credit for opening it up to the wider world, because if you remember a few years back, I wrote the best 25 goals of the Football Italia era, and I put that one at number one. And I also had the piece that was on The Guardian a few weeks ago for the 20th anniversary. It's just, as David eloquently put, it's extraordinary. You know, we've all played football. I'm sure all three of us have played football at some level, 5-a-side, 11-a-side, 7-a-side, whatever. One of the hardest skills in the game is to control a ball that's coming over your shoulder out of the sky. Like, Pirlo pings it 40 yards. And he said himself, he always looked to see, once he got the ball, he always looked to see where Baggio was, either between the lines of midfield and defence or behind the defensive line. So he sees Baggio and he just pings it. And so the ball is coming down. And like, it's kind of like I said, to control it and direct it in one touch, you know, like if that was either the three of us, you take one touch, two touch, three touch, four touch to steady yourself, decide what you're going to do before any defenders come. But he paints a picture in his head of what he's doing before the ball even arrives. And it's the most gorgeous velvet touch that you could ever imagine a footballer producing. I personally think it's the greatest first touch in the history of the game. Considering the level, considering the stakes, considering Baggio wasn't at his peak, he was 34. Considering the opposition, considering who the manager was, considering what it meant.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Any words that I try to put down on paper or say, articulate, isn't good enough. You just need to watch it. That's all you simply have to do.
It's hard to do it justice.
Yeah, there are no words that one can put forward to describe just how the elegance is just...
and the people he had to beat to score that goal. You had Marco Giuliano, who I think was first choice for Dino Zoff's Italian three-man defence in the year 2000. And he had to beat some big names.
Ciro Ferrara.
To make that. Ciro Ferrara was at the back with him. And then you had Birindelli, who was very, you know, he was quite a prominent player at the time. He usually played on the right or left, depending on where Juventus needed him. Zambrotta and Pesotto were in that team as well. By then, though, Michele Paramatti came on.
Yeah.
As well as Igor Tudor. And also, Juventus had a player by the name of Atirson, which I have no recollection of. He's up there with maybe Gresco for me from Inter, but... sorry, there was just a little punching bag, a little virtual one that, in front of me. But Atirson, he came on. He didn't make... I looked him up. He hasn't made too many appearances for Juventus at his time there, but he was on the park as well. So I think by then, Giuliano had come off, as well as Birindelli, but Paramatti and Tudor were on. So Pesotto was still there, Birindelli was still there, and the big one for me was Ciro Ferrara, as well as Edwin van der Sar in the goal. And he was in two minds, no man's land. And it's up for debate whether that's Baggio's best goal ever. There's you know, a lot of people will, you know, they will nominate so many of his goals. In my opinion, it was one of his most devastating goals in terms of what it meant for his club, him personally, and also what it meant for Juventus' chances of chasing down Roma in first place. The next round, in round 25, Roma went on to lose to Fiorentina 3-1. That was after they'd managed to come back against Verona on the same day that Juventus Brescia was being played. So Roma then went on to lose to Fiorentina, which is Battistuta's old club. He lost against them. That allowed Juventus back into the title race. And they beat Verona. They went on to beat Verona. Brescia went on to sink Inter that year. Another little punch there. Thanks.
Everybody beat Inter that season.
Yeah. But guess who scored the goal? It was one Roberto Baggio from the spot. So he got a goal against Juventus, which is one of his old clubs. He went on to sink Inter, one of his old clubs that he just joined from. Then Lecce got a 1-1 draw at the Delle Alpi from Juventus. Juventus faced Roma later in the season. They were 2-0 ahead after a few minutes. Del Piero and Zidane scored. Then it was Hidetoshi Nakata and Vincenzo Montella who scored two very, very late goals. And that ended 2-2.
Yeah.
And they needed to chase Roma down. So there was 2 points just dissipated into thin air. The Scudetto was won by Roma eventually with 75 points over Juventus on 73. The difference was effectively the Bajor goal in the 85th minute. Brescia up against Juventus. Brescia finished in eighth spot. They lost just 10 games that year. They ground out 24 results. So Dario Hübner with another big season, 17 goals in Serie A. Bajor finished with 10 very important goals for his club in his first four seasons at Brescia. I think he scored double digits every season.
Yeah.
And that goal against Juventus sparked a six-game scoring streak for Bajor. He ended up with 45 goals, I think, at Brescia over the four seasons. So double digits every season. Not bad considering he suffered that horrific injury in 2001 and 2002 and only played 12 times in that season where he was injured. And he still scored 11 goals in that season. And that was a World Cup year as well in 2002, where he would have been in great form and possibly got a call up from Trapattoni. So things could have been different in the Japan-South Korea World Cup for Italy. But going back to Juventus and Brescia, that's what that goal meant. All those things I've just listed. So,
Brescia going a great run after this draw. Like they remain unbeaten for the rest of the campaign. And I think there was 10 games left after this game. And they don't lose. They win or draw. And they end up qualifying for the Intertoto Cup.
That's right, yeah.
Which has been their first foray into Europe. And they get to the final and they lose technically. But they play Paris Saint-Germain over two legs. And they lose in away goals. The first leg is 0-0 in Paris. And then it's 1-1 at the Rigamonte. And they go out and away goals. So it would have been nice to see them in a UEFA Cup run. Obviously, you don't know how far they would have gone because Bajor gets injured. It's quite a serious knee injury. I think he sustains two injuries in that season. And that pretty much ruled him out for the majority of the season. And it's ridiculous, yeah. Too. He had such determination to make it to the 2002 World Cup. He tore his cruciate ligament. I think it's against, is it Parma or Venezia? And he returns in 77 days. Like, it's an injury.
It was a record.
An injury that should have ruled him out for like half a year. He comes back in like 2 months or 10 weeks or something ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it was the healing powers of Buddhism, because he was a Buddhist, so which probably effectively ruled him out from Trapattoni's plans. But anyway.
Yeah, so, trap with his holy water.
His holy water, throwing it on the ball and then smashing into the screen there on the bench.
That was always the rumours too, that Del Piero and Totti didn't want Bajor to go to the World Cup because it would have taken the limelight off of them.
Yeah.
That was always absolutely. The rumours. And I mean, I think Bajor knew in himself that he wasn't going to be a starter. But I mean, if you need an impact sub, someone to come on for 15, 20 minutes at the end of a game, and considering how Del Piero played for Italy maybe 7-8 tournaments, and he was never good in a single one of them. Like, he never come close to doing what Bajor did at USA 94 or Italia 90 or France 98. And you kind of think, I would, like, even though I'm a Juventus fan, I would have left Del Piero at home.
Yeah.
And brought Bajor 10 times out of 10.
Well, that's because you're not biased. All the Juventini I knew back then were swearing, you know, black and white, we'll say, that Del Piero needs to go. Bajor, nah, he's finished. I used to get some Juventini, and I don't want to accuse them of being plastic fans, but they used to ask me, oh, you know, this is by 2006 in that World Cup. Oh, is Bajor and Maldini playing? And I'm like, obviously people that just get up and check the results in the morning in Australia without watching the games. But Del Piero at the big tournaments. Apart from 2006, he played okay, and he put it. Yeah. The goal he scored against Germany, I'll give him credit for. I mean, he's a magnificent player, but when there's Roberto Baggio, I think even Alessandro Del Piero would admit, you know, maybe I should have stayed home. But you know, immense. He scored that goal against Germany, although it was for 2-0.
Yeah, it wasn't the icebreaker.
I would like to see if it was nil all at the time, if that ball would have gone straight at the keeper a la Euro 2000 in that final against France. So.
Yeah, that's what I've always said. The two chances in Euro 2000 that Del Piero had if you put Baggio in that situation, Italy win the Euros.
You'd win 3-0.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Italy were dominating that game as well. It was, I think, who scored the equaliser? It was Wiltord.
Sylvain Wiltord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, that goal goes in. Of course, a goal can be, you've only got a 1-0 lead. Anything can happen. But it should have been 2-0, possibly 3-0 at the time for Italy. Italy dominated the game. Even with the likes of Del Vecchio in the squad, up against another team that you need the superpowers of Roberto Baggio to beat with Zinedine Zidane in the opposing team. So I guess it ended up happening a couple of years later when Brescia went to Turin to take on Juventus that day. So just a game that sticks out in my memory. There was a couple of other games that I was going to go with. I won't say what they are in case other people are going to use them, though. But most of them featured Roberto Baggio, I'll be honest.
never a bad choice.
You'll have to come back on and do another one, potentially. One question for you before we let you go was, sure. Do you remember what the atmosphere was in the cafe? I always like thinking about, sort of painting that picture of what it was like, because sometimes, you see what a goal like that and it's just different level. It makes it worth for you guys, for instance, getting up at that hour, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, at the time, it didn't matter what game they had on. You always ended up with class. Every week, it was worth going to watch them. And it didn't matter if it was one of the lower games that they could show, the evening kickoff. But the atmosphere for that goal was more disbelief. Everyone was a Juventino fan. No one was a Brescia fan. I'm not a Brescia fan, but I was there supporting Baggio. So I was the Brescia fan along with my friend, Robbie, at the time. And there's two of us, everyone else was a Juventino. It was disbelief. And it's not the sort of that feeling that maybe you're picturing there, Richard, that people are jumping up for joy that Roberto Baggio scored. It was more appreciation of the goal, but absolute horror that Juventus had suffered an equaliser in the last few minutes, especially after it was one-way traffic for most of the game. And it took one moment of class, one magnificent long ball over the top to arguably the best player to ever play in Serie A, and the finish, exquisite.
It was also a measure of revenge for Baggio.
Exactly.
Because Ancelotti had rejected him when he had the chance to sign him for Parma in the summer of 1987.
He did.
Ancelotti personally vetoed the deal. He was like, "Nah, I've got Hernan Crespo and Enrico Chiesa. I play 4-4-2. There's no room for a Trequartista." And so Baggio then goes to Bologna. So it's a small measure of revenge, I think, on Baggio's part.
Yeah, and look what happened at Bologna. He went there and unleashed the fury. He scored 22 goals. It was his best ever season. It helped Bologna to, I think, one of their best place finishes for a while, since they haven't won it since the 60s. So, they had a couple of good players at Bologna, but they had Carlo Nervo. In midfield, the club stalwart. But besides that, they had no one. And they finished...
Igor Kolivanov and Kenneth Anderson.
Kenneth Anderson out there as well. And Baggio left them for dead. And it was the year that, ironically, he shaved off the Divino Cordino. So, you've got that no ponytail. Baggio means business. And he's ready for that 98 World Cup. And effectively, that's what gets him called up by Cesare Maldini. There was no excuses. They had to take him, even though Del Piero went injured. And that first game, I remember, against Chile with Baggio and Vieri up front was, sorry to say this, but every teenage Italian boy's wet dream. So it was, don't want to put any visuals out there for anyone, but yeah, it was definitely the lineup that most people wanted to see. And you saw Baggio with that assist for Vieri's first goal.
Oh, the touch. Again, the first touch.
And yeah.
Yeah, he had it all through his career. And even until he retired in 2004, he was still belting in the goals. I think that was a season that he scored over 200 as well. And he got the goal against Parma on his left as well. So another goal on his left boot. That's one detail I think I left out, was that he put this away on his left foot, the goal against Juventus for that 1-1 draw. And, you couldn't tell the difference between his left and right during the game anyway, but long range shots and free kicks were always on his right foot. And spectacular player for me, my favorite of all time. 54 years old now, I think. And you know what? Take him to the A-League in Australia. He could probably score a few there. So
probably could. Yeah. Well, David, thank you so much for coming and sharing those memories, because it's been great to go back and just relive that, properly relive it, with a fantastic, fantastic description from yourself. Just if anyone wants to, you know, hook up and follow you or see what you're doing, where can they do that?
I am on Twitter, David_Farini_. Also put together a site. So there's a few things on there, a little bit of writing as well, some highlights from some of the games I do that are on the Serie A channel. I sort of repost the links as well as the Lega Serie A links on Twitter. So the next game I'm doing, I'm not sure when this podcast is going to air, but I'm doing Sassuolo versus Sampdoria, which is the current legend Fabio Quagliarella, who will be playing up against Domenico Berardi, the best player, one of the best players in the league this year. So that'll be good. But yeah, Twitter is the main place.
That'll be a great game. Well, thank you very much, Emmett. Thank you very much, David. We're all going to go off and watch endless clips of Roberto Baggio on YouTube.
So yes.
It's ciao for now.